This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Economists. I'm Peter Martin.
And I'm Gigi Foster. Hello.
Gigi, until this week, inflation had been just 1.1%. Can you believe that? 1.1% per year. Now, I know a lot of people don't believe that, and it's a topic we're going to get into. Can we really believe that prices have only been climbing 1.1%? But as of Wednesday, the reported rate is 3.8%, an amazing and sudden jump. That's partly perhaps due to one-off special circumstances and partly because inflation is roaring back. I remember well when Australia's Treasurer Peter Costello declared he'd killed the inflation dragon. It was 1999 and then the rate had just fallen to 1.1%. Actually, he made the mistake of using the word dragon more than once, and with my colleague Mark Colvin on PM, we made fun of it.
Who needs St. George? The Treasurer today portrayed himself as a dragon slayer. There is, says Peter Costello, no life left in the inflation dragon. Our economics correspondent Peter Martin reports.
The legend you are about to hear is true.
Today's figures show there's no life in the inflation dragon. The dragon's not stirring.
I assume there was serious analysis in your report that night as well, Peter?
Yeah, there was. It's sort of like the sugar coating there. Now, I'm surprised they let me get away with it. But the Treasurer was right. Inflation had been killed when the Treasurer, Peter Costello, came to office. It was 5%. Before that, it was 8 to 10%. He and the Reserve Bank were ruthless about beating it down. Basically, it's remained dormant ever since, averaging 2-2.5%. They killed it.
But so before asking why they would want to kill it and what's so bad about high inflation and what's apparently now so bad about low inflation, we first have to get a handle on what it actually is. Right. So inflation is a general rise in prices across the economy, prices of food, petrol, labor, meaning wages, and everything else that we buy and sell. And if all of those prices, including wages, rise at the same rate within a country, then in theory, there isn't a problem. Although I would say really high inflation might throw off people's mental shortcuts for things like, you know, how much money do I need to budget to buy groceries this week?
It's a bit hard to calculate.
Exactly. Or, you know, you go to a store, you don't know whether it's a good price because, you know, inflation going up so fast. But what exactly, how do we measure this concept of the, you know, total rise in prices across the whole economy? Well, the Consumer Price Index, or CPI, is the main tool we use to gauge the level of inflation. But of course, like all measures, it isn't perfect. So what is the CPI, and why do some people seem not to trust it? They say the prices have actually been climbing by more than 1% per year.
Yeah, if you survey people, you'll find they say 3 to 4%.
That's right.
They don't believe 1%. I think part of the reason is lots of the prices they can see are rising. Those petrol station prices, they're displayed in big letters.
Yeah, they've gone up a lot. Gosh, yeah.
But you see them as you drive in. The law requires you to see them. Electricity bills. Electricity is a tiny amount of spending. We spend more on more on alcohol than electricity. But those bills are big. They come every quarter, so they're big by the time they come. And when we spend on alcohol, how can I put this, Gigi? We spend a little bit at a time and we get an instant reward.
Gratification.
Whereas we don't for electricity, right?
Yeah, that's right.
We've already had the electricity. We don't for petrol. You know, we've already driven the car. So I think there's some of that. But the index is a lot better than it was. In the last few years, there's been a revolution below the hood in how it's put together. And I am more confident than ever that it reflects how prices are actually moving. And we use it to adjust wages in Australia, not in every other country.
Indeed, not in the United States.
not in your country.
And that's a big reason why inflation is a problem.
Real wages, the difference between wages and prices, and real wages are going back in the US. Here we won't let that happen. Mm. We have the Fair Work Commission. So the number matters. We're going to talk to someone who knows how it's put together. We're going to talk to someone who can tell us what the implications of Wednesday's news are.
To help us out, we're joined by perhaps Australia's leading expert, perhaps one of the world's leading experts on this topic. Professor Kevin Fox is a specialist in the field of economic measurement and a colleague of mine at UNSW whose work in the past few years has led to a revolution in the way price indexes are created in the United States, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Norway, Sweden, New Zealand, and Australia, with potential changes in the works also in Canada and the United Kingdom. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Gigi.
First, Kevin, the most basic question of all, what is a consumer price index?
Well, it's the average change of prices experienced by households, and it's measured by taking a basket of goods and seeing how that the prices for that basket of goods changes over time.
Any basket? How does the Bureau decide what gets to be in the representative basket?
Well, there are a number of expenditure class categories, such as food and non-alcoholic beverages. And within that, there's bread and cereal products. And then bread and cereal products are broken down into bread, cakes and biscuits, breakfast cereals and other cereal products.
All in the proportions that we buy them on average.
Yes. And so they've got some weights that they get from household expenditure surveys for each of these categories. And so these days, any national statistical office is taking price samples, collecting prices on a huge range of products.
So if the consumer price index is a change, an average change in the average price of the average basket of the average Australian, right, then so if it's 2%, that means the average of all of those things is a rise of 2%. The individual person on the street is going to look at that potentially and say, well, that doesn't match what I buy. And if that person spends a lot more of his income on, let's say, childcare or instant coffee or housing than what is in the average, then he may feel a very different impact on how much he has to spend in order to keep up his standard of living, yeah?
Yes, that's right. I mean, we can't create a price index for every living Australian. We've got to look at the purpose of a consumer price index. And it's got multiple different purposes, including indexation for wage purposes. Business contracts are often also indexed to the consumer price index. Welfare payments. So we can't work out an inflation rate for every living Australian and apply an appropriate index for them, but it is extremely useful in a broad range of applications. And of course, it informs interest rate policy in Australia.
Are there some things missing? Prostitution would, on the face of it, be one. Illegal drugs would be another. People say housing is missing, although it seems to be in there in various ways.
Okay, so some things are not included. First, prostitution and illegal drugs are not included. Some countries have made an attempt to include these in the CPI. Now, why wouldn't we want to have those in there? Well, one reason is it's very difficult to collect accurate data.
You phrased that very delicately.
Gambling is another one which is excluded simply because there are various conceptual issues around that. And superannuation fees, et cetera, as well. Now, you mentioned housing. It's probably worth just noting something on that. There are different conceptual bases for constructing consumer price indexes. What the ABS does is consistent with most national statistical offices and using the acquisitions approach. So that will exclude mortgage payments. The acquisitions approach is about what you buy in that particular period. So it excludes things like assets or purchase of assets. And so the idea of the mortgage payments, well, what exactly is that? Well, the idea is it's probably contributing to the purchase of an asset.
In the same way as if you borrowed money to buy shares.
That's right. And the purchase of shares are also excluded. What is included is the purchase of new housing net of land costs.
But that does mean that if you're paying off a mortgage and if the prices of those payments go up, then that may not be captured. And indeed, having a single figure for CPI is really papering over the potential differences in the rate of inflation in different sectors that people interact with, right? So it could be that, for example, in the housing market as a whole, there is a particular rate of inflation of, I don't know, 4 or 5%, but in I don't know, food, there's a rate of inflation of 2%, and maybe in wages, you know, the wages feed through from the CPI only gets an uptick of 3%. And so then there's this mismatch between the rate of increase in the prices that inform people's incomes, like wages, and the prices that inform their outlays. And that can be a real problem for people, yeah?
Yeah, so the CPI is just one number that comes out, but the ABS actually produces analytical series, which includes things like mortgage payments. So this is with living cost indexes. So they are published by the ABS. They get less attention than the CPI, but there are these other indexes for, say, pensioners and beneficiaries, which includes mortgage repayments.
Oh, I see. So does that mean then that those cost of living index values for the different subgroups in our economy are used to adjust the incomes, for example, the pensioners' payments or wages in a particular occupation?
Yes, I mean, they're constructed for that purpose.
Now, what do you do in the increasingly common instance where a product is not what it was? Mobile phones is one. Computers, laptops are another. They have twice the memory they did, twice the speed. It wouldn't be right just to record the price, but it's not clear what you should do. I can't imagine that a computer that's twice as fast should be recorded as being twice as valuable.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. This is a great point, and it's one which we've struggled with since the 1930s. People at the time observed that the quality of cars was increasing dramatically, and yet the prices were not increasing at the same rate. When we think about quality change these days, we think about a lot of high-tech products. Now, the new good that's come in, that doesn't get ignored. That eventually gets into the CPI basket when it's there for two periods. Because we're always measuring change, we need the good to be in there for two periods before we can get its price change. And it's a problem. The problem is when new good comes in, there's no price to match it with, and the old good exits, there's nothing to match it with. And so methods have been developed to do that. Now, there's a common perception that a lot of very sophisticated modelling is done in consumer price indexes. Not so much in Australia. It's quite straightforward methods. For PCs, personal computers, what's used, I believe, is the US price index for computers, and that adjusts for different changes in different product categories. So there, explicitly, the value of extra RAM is estimated, for example, and adjustments are made. But that is the only product for which such hedonic modelling, we call it, is used to adjust prices in the Australian CPI. So things like smartphones, etc., laptops, they do not get that sort of treatment, which could be viewed as somewhat problematic.
So let me ask you about another challenge to CPI. So a few years ago, I wrote a paper about how the cyclones in Queensland had made banana prices across Australia spike, because, of course, we don't allow import of bananas. And so I don't know if you remember, Kevin, but I'm sure you do, going to the supermarket.
I do.
Yeah, $18 a kilo for bananas, crazy. Obviously, in that sort of scenario, the consumer who looks at that price is going to substitute away from bananas and towards other fruits. Did the CPI at that time take account of that switching or substitution across goods when, obviously, one of the prices rises hugely disproportionately to the other prices in a similar category?
Don't pay it.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't pay the high price.
They might buy one banana instead of, 17.
They might buy apples.
Yeah. Yes. So a way of addressing that is to update your weights, get more frequent information included in your price index. Now, that's what the ABS has done through the use of scanner data. So this is electronic point of sales supermarket data included into the CPI as well.
This means, by the way, and you've been part of this, that you've gone from thousands of prices being measured to millions.
That's correct.
And so, you know how much is bought.
Yes. The traditional way of doing things for supermarket products, for example, was to send out people who go into a supermarket, find an item which they've been asked to find, say a particular type of flour, they write down the price. So that's the price on the shelf, but we don't know in that case if anyone bought the flour at that price. With scanner data, we know a certain price, a certain amount of flour was purchased. And this is a huge transformation because we've got prices and quantities, and that's really what we need to construct price indexes. So this is quite a revolution. It's very much big data stuff. Statistical agencies, we're getting their hands on the data, and problem was when you try and put these data into standard index number compilation methods, the indexes can become explosive, which means that the indexes can zip off to a very high number or a very low number very quickly.
You solved that problem for agencies worldwide, right?
Yes, we did, in collaboration with the ABS and Statistics Netherlands through an Australian Research Council linkage grant. We were able to solve this problem, and our methods, our class of methods for doing this have been adopted in multiple countries around the world, including in Australia from 2017, which is very gratifying to see. And what this means is that we know at the micro level about these shifts in consumption.
Next time bananas go up, next time there's a cyclone in Queensland, will the ABS not push up the whole fruit index and the whole CPI, because prices that people can't even see and can't even pay, most of them, are soaring, and simply note that bananas were not bought much and should be given a low weighting?
Yeah, so you can see this with the ABS responses to COVID-19. Last year, there were massive changes in consumption patterns in some expenditure classes. Fortunately, because the ABS was using scanner data, it knew exactly what was happening, and it was feeding in automatically into adjustments into the CPI.
This would be sanitizer, masks,
toilet paper.
Yep. They were able to get a very good idea about these shifts in expenditure. And then they were, as I mentioned earlier, they were able to adjust the weights given to certain expenditure classes as well at the more aggregate level.
And for fuel prices, the ABS also gets the same information. That is, not only the price that's on the board, but how much of it people bought at each price. So this revolution, and congratulations, means that the index, whereas once it was a cost of fixed basket index, it's now much more an actual cost of living index. The petrol people actually buy, the goods people actually buy at each price.
Yes, you've gone from having a few thousand products to millions of products, and having the scanner data allows new products to be introduced into the consumer price index more quickly.
Kevin Fox, thanks for joining us today and for helping to bring the consumer price index into the 21st century here in Australia, and for saving the Bureau of Statistics a lot of money in the process. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is The Economists on RN with me, Peter Martin. I'm an economics editor, and Gigi Foster, she's an economics professor. And in this most extraordinary week, when Australia's rate of inflation jumped from a barely alive 1.1% to 3.8%, it's time to ask whether there's reason to be worried. Like me, since the 1980s, Nikki Hutley has been tracing the CPI for a living every 3 months. In a sense, Nikki, we've grown up with it as it has shrunk. Nikki is an economic consultant. She's previously worked as a senior economist in both the private and government sectors. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
It's a historic week. It might be seen as the week the dragon roared back to life. What's so bad about that anyway? Why are people so concerned about high inflation?
Well, those of us that are old enough to remember the days when inflation was both high and out of control, and those two things often go together, remember how very high inflation erodes the value of your savings. It makes it much harder to afford things, because typically when inflation is running very fast, it's running much, much faster than your wages are. And so things become far less affordable. Governments tend to lose control. If it gets too fast, they then have very few options. We've seen what happens when they don't slam on the brakes. You can go back to Germany just before the war, more recently Argentina, where hyperinflation is just, you know, means you've got literally banknotes in a wheelbarrow to be able to pay for an apple.
Yeah, but that couldn't happen here, right?
Well, the only reason it couldn't happen is because the Reserve Bank of Australia, like many central banks since the 1980s, has been really sharply focused on keeping inflation under control.
That means that some of the damage that is done by high inflation is, in fact, the efforts to control it. That if the Reserve Bank pushed up interest rates to control it, that would be, in fact, the more likely cause of damage to the economy.
Yes, so those of us that were around in the early 1990s, and you and I would live right through this one, Peter, was the recession that we had to have, famously, Paul Keating told us, Treasurer at the time, because it was the only way we could get the wage price spiral back in control. And no one wants to go through that again.
The Reserve Bank now has a target of doing what it can to keep inflation between 2 and 3%. If what you're saying is right about the dangers of inflation, why should the target be 2 to 3%? Why not zero?
So a little bit of inflation is actually good. We need to encourage people to borrow and invest, and a little bit of inflation does that. It encourages people to buy now. If you have disinflation, people defer their spending and investment, and you get the economy going into recession as well. It helps to provide for wage rises and erodes the value of debt, so encouraging, as I said, that borrowing and investment. So a little bit of inflation kind of greases the wheels of the economy. But it's you've got to keep it in control. And that's the very hard task that central banks face, is to not let it get too low, but not let it get too high. 2 to 3% is just what the Australian Reserve Bank thinks is the right thing. Other economies have slightly lower targets. The US, for example, 2% is the ceiling. There's been a lot of argument in Australia in the last, particularly the last decade, that maybe it's too high in Australia, that 1% to 2% is probably more appropriate given factors like globalisation. But for the moment, the RBA thinks 2 to 3 is a perfectly good target band.
What do you think then about the rate that was released, 3.8%? Does that move us out of this Goldilocks band?
No, because that's the headline number. And if we look at the trimmed mean, which takes out all the crazy one-offs that we know aren't going to be repeated, that was still at 1.6%, you know, below the band and where we need to have it. There were some crazy things in there, including to do with COVID-free childcare for a while, very high petrol prices, which seems quite at odds with the fact that people are driving less during a pandemic, but I guess global oil prices aren't taking much notice of that at the moment. So there were some things in there that just aren't going to carry on. That underlying inflation rate, that's the most important thing. What's in there that's going to keep on continuing? I think probably what's more worrying is what we've seen elsewhere in the world, particularly the US, which suggests that that underlying inflation trend is rising higher, and Australia often follows the US. You know, there's no doubt that there are building inflationary pressures at the moment, particularly as demand in the economy, when we've had all this massive stimulus from both monetary and fiscal policy, has been lifting demand, at least up until the latest set of lockdowns.
Yeah. So let me just clarify for our listeners. The reason why the free childcare issue is an impactful one here is that in June 2020, which is the sort of the baseline against which we're comparing inflation now, there was free childcare, right? And so that element of spending was zero, essentially. And there may have been other changes as well. And so we're comparing against that base rate. And in fact, back then, a year ago, wasn't inflation reported to be negative?
It was. It fell quite substantially during the quarter, exactly because of those reasons. Mm. So the Bureau of Statistics is at pains to point out and give lots of nice explanatory notes and have done right over the course of the year to say, look, this is what's working in this direction. This is what you need to be aware of, these weird trends. So statisticians' lives are very difficult at the moment, but they're being as helpful as they possibly can in explaining those one-off things.
What signs are there of genuine inflation pressure? You say they're in the US. If so, they're probably here too. At least things to be worried about.
Look, I don't think there's that much to be worried about per se. I mean, there's two types of inflationary pressures. One comes from wages building up, and there's really not that much sign at the moment that wages pressure is at going at a really fast pace. It seems to be picking up a little bit, and there's certainly anecdotal evidence that skill shortages might be pushing up wages in some sectors, but not right across the board. The minimum wage rise of just over, around 2.5%, that will flow through to lots of other sectors. So that's a pretty reasonable level. The other factor, of course, is demand. And when you get a lot of demand chasing not enough supply,
then demand is rising. Really, demand is a word for spending, right? Mm.
Yes. So when consumers get out there, last year, of course, with everyone in lockdown, we were spending lots more money on our homes. We were doing, for example, lots more renovations. And you can see the price of household product inflation has gone up quite substantially. You know, so a nice demonstration of economic theory working in practice, that when we put a lot of pressure, we start to spend heavily in one area, unless we increase the supply or production a lot, we're going to get price pressure.
And would it also be that we have higher demand because people are staying here in Australia because of the closed borders rather than going overseas and spending on holidays and whatnot? And so we're just getting a higher level of demand across the board? Or is that going to be counteracted by the fact that we don't have the excess demand we'd have with immigrants coming in or educational, you know, students, for example?
Yeah, this is a fascinating one because everyone thinks, oh, there's no tourism, that's really bad. But in fact, Australian tourists spend more overseas than international tourists spend in Australia. So there is, in fact, more money being spent domestically by not having those tourists. It's just where it's being spent. Obviously, if you're highly exposed to the international tourism, like a CBD hotel in Sydney or Melbourne, you're not doing so well. But all that money that we would have spent going to Bali or wherever is being ploughed back into whole new things, into regional holidays when we're allowed to, renovating our homes or buying puppies. You know, there's been a pet explosion as well.
Really?
Yep. A lot of the things that are driving inflation now are also not permanent. So we need to remember that this isn't about a significant shift in the structure of economies that mean that supply can't meet demand and that we're going to see prices start to rise. So I'm not worried, to be honest, about the long-term inflationary trends.
But it would mean higher interest rates to bring it down if it goes up. And I suppose there's a bit of room for higher interest rates at the moment.
Well, there's an awful lot of room, particularly if you're someone whose first mortgage was closer to 20% than 1%.
So, in the 80s.
Yes, for those of us old enough to remember the awful 80s and what really high inflation looked like and the interest rate response. Look, you know, we've seen rates move up here when things were getting a bit out of control, when we had the commodities boom in the last, you know, well, decade or so ago. You know, they will go up. And for a lot of people who've got big mortgages and big servicing costs, that can be quite scary. But if banks are being sensible, they are supposed to be lending with a margin of 2.5% at least. Most people at the moment should be covered by that buffer. But as we start to move, I guess, back to more normal levels of inflation and interest rates, you know, then people will have to start reassessing. But I don't think that's likely to happen for a couple of years at least.
And probably the lockdown in Sydney, the lockdowns we've seen in other states are probably, if you like, not that there's anything really good about them, but they're probably taking the pressure out of inflation for the moment or postponing what you're seeing.
Oh, they absolutely are. If you have a look at the latest, for example, ANZ's credit card stats that have just come out, you know, that the spending in Sydney is at very, very low levels. It's similar to where it was at the height of the lockdowns last year, which is quite alarming, even for things like groceries, which suggests that, you know, the removal of a lot of government expenditure, the stimulus, things like the coronavirus supplement is having an effect on household spending, and that will definitely be a dampener on prices. But definitely I wouldn't call that a silver lining or even something to be positive about. Yeah, it's a worry.
Thank you so much for joining us, Nikki Hadley.
My pleasure. Thanks, Peter. Thanks, Gigi.
Thanks, Nikki. Head to The Economist's website for lots of links about the way the Consumer Price Index is calculated and both sides of the debate on whether or not inflation is about to come roaring back.
That's also where you can send us your thoughts about this and next week's topic, China, trade, and whether we need China more than it needs us. We seem to be picking the big topics, Gigi. It'll be on for young and old. What a time to be an economist. Goodbye till then.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.